everyone, to a new episode of The Cusp Show, the Columbia University sports podcast, where we talk about the business of sports, and we're fortunate to have discussions with the industry's best and brightest executives and personalities. As usual, I'm joined by my co-host, Joe Favorito. Welcome, Joe, to a new show.
Thanks, Tom.
Good to have you, and I'm excited about today's discussion because we have a colleague on the podcast today. We have Carla Varialli, who, in addition to being a lawyer in the industry, is also on the faculty with us at Columbia and has been teaching, I believe, for about 8 years. So, Carla, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Really good to have you. And I'll let everybody know that you're now an attorney with Havikins, Rosenfeld, Ritzert, and Varialli, that you're involved in a lot of exciting things in this business of sports on the legal side. Which, of course, anybody who has even a remote knowledge of the sports business knows there are a lot of legal issues, and they just keep coming with all these big business developments and changes that have occurred in this industry over the last 10 or 15 years. So, Carla, let's actually start with you giving the audience a little bit about your background, how you got into the business, and then talk a little bit more about specifically what you're working on now, and then we'll get into some of the topics that you're covering. And also try to marry up the kinds of things you're actually dealing with as an attorney day-to-day in this industry and what you're actually talking about in the classroom where you're teaching sports law and ethics and now some stuff about the legalities of mixed martial arts.
Right. Well, I've been a lawyer for about 20 years. My background is in litigation, and I came to the sports end of it in sort of a roundabout way. Many years ago, I was working on a case that involved the New York Mets general counsel, and we just really worked very well together. We had long hours. It was a very difficult case, and at the resolution of the case, he decided to keep me on, and we have worked together on numerous cases with my firm as outside counsel, and the cases really run the gamut, everything from over the years we've dealt with a range of spectator injury issues, we've dealt with the rights of publicity and fans in the stand and whether their privacy had been invaded when they were depicted on Diamond Vision, some contract and waiver of liability issues, really a nice range of work together, and they're a terrific client to partner with. But I should preface this, too, by telling you when I started to work with them, I am not a sports fan, and I am just a fan of the business of sports. So I can't even name more than 3 or 4 players on the team to this day.
Okay.
But I know, which is really, you know, it drives many of my colleagues crazy. But the business of the sport and also the evolving nature of the sport and the opportunities on the business end of it is something that is enormously fascinating to me.
Yeah, I mean, has working in it made you more of a fan as the years have rolled by?
Yeah, well, I was very excited when they were in the World Series.
Right.
So I guess the answer to that is yes. Yeah, and of course I care enormously that they do well, and so from that perspective, I'm a fan. And again, they're a wonderful collection of people to work for, very professional and just fun and dedicated.
So what are some of the – I mean, there's a lot of – you mentioned a bunch of interesting topics. What are some of the specific things you've been working on and paying attention to where you've been able to really delve deeply into a topic and really have been able to both practice it professionally and then educate young people about it in the classroom?
Well, something that comes to mind immediately is known as the baseball rule. And for many, many years in many jurisdictions, courts held that a baseball owner, operator, stadium proprietor need only provide screening in the area behind home plate where a spectator's risk of injury was the greatest. Now, over time, that has been challenged in many different jurisdictions in many ways. There have been studies done to show where the trajectory of the ball is, and that is not in the area directly behind home plate. It is the third baseline. People have challenged that the speed of the ball has changed, so the calculus of the risk has changed dramatically. There have been any number of creative attacks on that. And in fact, some jurisdictions over time have adopted what I would call a more commercial premises standard of liability. But as we all know, the baseball stadium is not like a shopping mall or a movie theater. I mean, of course, there are promotional items that are tossed into the stands, the presence of baseballs, breaking bats. So it's been very interesting to see sort of the patchwork of precedent across the U.S. But one of the things that I think is very interesting is a recent case, a class action lawsuit brought by Spectators in the Northern District of California. And one of the things that was argued in that case is now that, for example, many parks are equipped with Wi-Fi and it has become a distraction, and they've enhanced the distraction, particularly of young children, and that this is now being challenged in a class action suit, meaning the ability to interact with your smartphone and track the game has somehow now made it more dangerous. I'm not sure what that says about us as a culture, as a country, that we think somebody else should be responsible for a failure to pay attention to a baseball game. So I'd be very interested to see how that pans out.
Actually, I know Joe has a question, but let me ask you a quick one, a quick follow-up to that. What are we fans agreeing to when we go into Yankee Stadium or Citi Field exactly? Because I know most of us don't read the fine print on the back of the physical ticket or the stuff in the terms of service or whatever it's called in an e-ticket.
Well, do you mean what are your legal rights as a fan or spectator?
Yeah, so for example, if you were one of those people that were affected, were hit, let's say, with the baseball while you were checking your email on your cell phone, I mean, how are you going to handle that? Or how can you handle that legally if you're a fan?
Well, I think if somebody has unreasonably enhanced the risk, you may have a case. And that's where lawyers get creative. What is an unreasonable enhancement of the risk? Some people have argued that it's the presence of vendors. Some people have argued that it's the presence of entertainment and promotional activities at the stadium. Some people had even argued at one point that because of the steroid era, that balls were getting hit into the stands at a greater velocity and a greater speed. I mean, all these are the province of a creative attorney. To me, you're not watching from a protected area, you have an obvious risk of injury associated with being a spectator. But the second part, I think, of your question is when you buy a ticket, and I hear this quite frequently in my practice, people think that they buy a ticket and they have a right to the seat for that game. In fact, what you have is a license. It's not a contract. You don't have a property interest in your seat. You are there. You know, I would use the phrase at the pleasure of the owner or the operator. If you are an unruly fan, if you are cursing, if you are running afoul of a conduct policy, you can be asked to leave. It's a license. You don't have a right to that seat. So that's sort of an interesting point about what your rights as a spectator are.
And then how does that translate over? I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but the issues with netting and safety really stemmed from an incident with the Columbus Blue Jackets where a young lady was killed getting hit by a puck. Does it change over to other sports, or do people kind of look at baseball because it's 162 games and the ball goes so fast and, oh, yeah, the NHL has put up netting and people have accepted it, or nobody ever gets hit with a football, or, you know, you've got instances, obviously, in NASCAR and Formula One with things going into the crowd. Does it translate over, or is everything kind of viewed individually per sport when things are litigated out?
What a great question. So there is actually a specialized duty of care known as the baseball rule. It just applies to baseball. But to your point, does it translate? Sure, because as people are putting on a family-centered entertainment, sports event. They want their fans. The interest is in keeping the fans safe. It's a really delicate balance between letting a spectator be up close and personal with the action, whether it's hockey, NASCAR, baseball, and providing protection. I really think the baseball rule strikes the perfect balance because it allows an owner or operator to provide a protected area for those spectators that want to avail themselves of that. Many spectators at a baseball game go with a glove. They want to catch a souvenir ball. They want to call out to a player and interact with a player in that way. I don't know that that happens at NASCAR. So baseball really is quite unique. I think there's been a big focus on spectator safety because of several issues that have been in the news, several really unfortunate and compelling issues that have been in the news. And I think that does translate into other sports. I think that there is a desire and an interest to make it safe and accessible and at the same time exciting. I think that's really a strong current issue that we're seeing now.
And someone who's caught exactly one foul ball in 42 years, I can say that it's still an interesting experience to do. Carla, just to transition about, not to talk about violence or to talk about other things, but you obviously have a really interesting perspective on mixed martial arts and the UFC. You were a big proponent of eventually the UFC being legalized in New York State. Why don't you let everyone know kind of a little bit about your kind of interest and in the business of mixed martial arts or the legality of mixed martial arts and kind of how that's played out over the years with your involvement.
Okay. So in New York was the last state in fact, the only place in North America where mixed martial arts was professional, was illegal. It had been banned in 1997. For about a decade, the UFC and others mounted a lobbying, a political, a legal challenge, and I got interested in this because I like politics. And here in New York, I could not understand why the professional version of the sport had been banned and could not even reach a vote in New York's assembly for almost a decade. It made no sense to me. And we all now know that when Sheldon Silver was convicted and faced his criminal issues and he was forced to leave politics, that same year we were able to get it passed. Here's the irony about the mixed martial arts situation in New York. The ban, which was so poorly drafted, there was an argument to be made that a person would not even know if they were violating the ban because it was arguably constitutionally void for vagueness. It didn't apprise you that what you were doing could be considered criminal activity. What that meant was pro was illegal, but amateur was legal, but basically unregulated and unsupervised. And all of this created an enormously dangerous and I would say undesirable climate for the amateur level of the sport. It made it more unsafe for fighters rather than making it safe. So pro was illegal, amateur was legal, but basically a Wild West. And the law needed to change. And it took nearly a decade, and it was really about political machinations why it had not. Columbia University started to study this issue about 2 or 3 years ago, and I think we are the first place, law school, sports management program, college class, that studied the legal issues and the challenges facing the sport here in New York. This year, now that the sport has been made legal, we're hosting a symposium, and I'm going to give a shameless plug, on August 15th in Skemmerhorn Hall at Columbia University. We will be hosting some of the industry leaders and people who are involved in the fight to get the sport legalized, and we're going to discuss what are the new challenges facing the sport? Now that pro is legal, what does this mean for the amateur scene? What does it mean for the professional athletes? What new business opportunities are there here? I mean, aren't we all looking forward to seeing a fight either at the Barclays Center or Madison Square Garden? I mean, this is next level stuff for this sport.
And Carla, will there be UFC executives there as the leading entity in America, or I guess the world, for mixed martial arts? Will they be represented? Are they participating in this?
They've expressed an interest. I'm going to see who we actually get. I think they have quite a bit on their plate right now with the potential or the rumored sale. So we'll see. Right now the guest list is still in flux, but I'll be publishing and publicizing that information as we get a little closer to the symposium. We do have as a moderator, he's a lawyer and an excellent MMA journalist. His name is Jim Genia, and he's really been at the forefront. He was actually an expert witness in the federal court lawsuit where the ban was getting challenged on the constitutional issues. So he's been around the sport. He knows it very well. He'll be moderating it for us, and I'm really, really excited to have him participate.
Is the event open to non-Columbia people?
Yes.
It is. So can you? Is there a place for people to check it out if they might be interested in pursuing getting a ticket?
We will be launching that information probably in the second week of July. I think that Columbia is still working out a couple of the details, but we know it will be in Skemmerhorn Hall.
Okay, that's terrific. That's going to be
August
an interesting
16th,
event.
I think it's going to be from 6 to 9, August, Tuesday, August 16th.
Carla, I have a related question about
sure.
that, because the construct of at least the UFC compared to, let's say, the NBA, NASCAR, et cetera, as it relates to labor is, I think, a little bit different. You probably know it a lot better than Joe and I do.
Mm-hmm.
But can you talk about that as a kind of a general question in this never-ending tension and sometimes strife that exists between these sports properties and their unions? Like, overall, I know this is a very general question, but is it getting better as more money has come into play? In other words, the pie is getting bigger. Does that mitigate some of these tensions that have existed historically in this business?
What a great question. I think the tensions, there's always going to be union tensions as long as there's labor and management. So I don't know that it gets better over time and as more money flows in. I think that just creates new things to negotiate about and new ways to think about dividing up the pie and keeping the talent happy, quite frankly.
Oh, no.
I think it presents numerous challenges.
It might actually, with more at stake, maybe it makes it worse over time. Who knows? It's a good question,
right.
I guess.
You know, it's somebody in my class last week where we were talking about the challenges facing mixed martial arts as a bit of an emerging sport, a rapidly emerging sport, brought up the fact that there was a deal with Reebok and sponsorship that sort of made a united front of fighters and agents and promoters who were, kind of aghast at it wasn't a very good deal. And there was some discussion about maybe this might spur MMA fighters to unionize and to mm-hmm. collectively bargain for things because of the sort of universal repugnance with regard to the Reebok deal.
And you have, obviously, a potential sale of the UFC,
yes.
which could affect that. And you've got someone like Conor McGregor, who's not fighting in UFC 200 because he felt that he was being his business interests weren't represented in the best way. So it'll be interesting to see kind of how all that plays out. Carla, what are the, in addition to, obviously, MMA, what are some of the other issues that you see or that you think will come to the forefront that people maybe aren't thinking about in the next year? You know, is it e-sport? Is it gambling? What are some of the things that are kind of on your radar going forward that you'll either be bringing into the classroom or you'll be dealing with professionally that you're not dealing with currently?
Well, I think the number one thing on my radar is the gambling and legalizing and regulating gambling. I am an Adam Silverian. I am a believer in let's bring it out of the darkness and into the light. I mean, here's an ironic fact for you. I live in Brooklyn. A few weeks ago, a 57-count criminal indictment for illegal gambling was announced by District Attorney Ken Thompson. I mean, that's a staggering amount of illegal gambling. I think that by bringing gambling into the light and out of the darkness, I think that you potentially are able to control it. You are able to monetize it. It's, I think the concerns about the quote-unquote integrity of the sport or threatening the integrity of the sport is a bit outmoded. I think when I heard Adam Silver speak at Columbia about a year or so ago, he mentioned the fact that, you know, we didn't eradicate Wall Street. What we did was have a mechanism in place to monitor, regulate, punish, deter, et cetera. Why not do the same thing with sports and gambling? And it's a huge underground business, meaning illegal gambling. I think the illegal gambling projections far dwarf what is going on in Las Vegas. And it presents a wonderful economic opportunity. It's something that can be harnessed and utilized. I mean, I happen to agree with Adam Silver when he says it's potentially a huge fan engagement tool.
Carl, it's funny. Yeah, last night, just coincidentally, I did in my digital media class, I did a class about sports gaming, and we talked, in addition to talking about esports and video gaming and fantasy, we talked about gambling, and I actually quoted a couple numbers, which you kind of just referenced, but specifically, just in the U.S. alone, the legal sports gambling market is $3.6 billion. The illegal is $140 billion. Worldwide, the illegal market is a little bit over $100 billion, and the illegal is almost half a trillion. It's refreshing to hear you say that you're an Adam Silverian. I'm also in that club. I really love the fact that he's gone public and been courageous enough to go public with an issue that most owners, I believe, in private are supportive of it, and many of them now publicly are being more open about it. Joe and I had the chance to have Ted Leonsis from the Capitals and Wizards involved with one of our programs, NYBC Sports, last year. He spoke very openly and very excitedly about the future legalization of sports gambling. Now you've heard Mark Cuban talk about it. David Stern, in his emeritus role, talks about it seemingly every time he's in public now, which I think is great. So we'll see where that goes. I know, unfortunately, we're running out of time. And one of the things, Carla, we like to ask our guests is, in this knowledge game that we're in, this information economy that we're all working in, how do you stay informed? How do you keep up with everything?
Gosh, I wish that I felt like I keep up with everything.
I didn't mean to give you a gotcha question like Sarah Palin or anything like that. So,
you know, my quick answer for that is I love my Twitter feed. I subscribe to and follow a number of sports lawyers, sports journalists, and they spoon feed me micro news in a way that works for me. And so I can go deeper if I want to on an issue, but it gives me the sort of depth and breadth that I need in order to key on to issues. So that's one way. I mean, I try to read the news. I'm still sort of an old school newspaper person, but the way life goes, more often than not, I'm reading it on my phone.
Uh-huh. Have you gotten into podcasts at all, or anything kind of in the digital realm beyond Twitter? Like, are you spending any time on Facebook or some of the sports blogs or anything like that?
Spend some time on that, but, you know, there's also, I do subscribe to a couple of podcasts, and the ones that I am subscribing to in the fashion and design world, because that really keeps me refreshed on the intellectual property laws and how rapidly they're changing. So I do listen. I wish I could listen to more of them, but I'll, while I'm on the subway or something, sometimes I'll listen in on that. They're a great tool. Podcasts are a great tool.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about that before, and obviously we're actually interacting on a podcast, so we're big believers, but I'm kind of amazed at the amount of extremely valuable content there is in podcasts right now, and I think if you're so inclined, as you kind of figure out your own little information ecosystem, you can find really great things for whatever you're into professionally, and it's a really good way to learn, especially beyond the classroom. Or, you know, we three have the good fortune of having a chance to actually reflect on some of these issues and topics week to week. So that said, Carla, starting to wrap up, so we have, we're all interacting with a lot of young people who are building their careers in this sports industry, you know, all different parts of the sports industry, from the media side to the legal side to analytics, the global sports market, et cetera. Do you have any perspective or some advice for the young people building there? Because I'm sure you're asked that a lot as a teacher in the program. I'm sure you do a lot of mentoring privately. But anything you can share more publicly that you think would be helpful?
I think, for example, I do so much work with young lawyers, and there is a wonderful organization called the Sports Lawyers Association that is, it really introduces people to others in the industry, and they are very strong on their networking and their dissemination of legal information affecting the sports industry. So that's on the legal side. And I think that there's also so many informal and wonderful mentoring opportunities. For example, even at Columbia, I mean, I am in touch with my students from 8 years ago, and I still meet with and give them advice, or I just love to hear information about their progress. I think building on your alumni network is really critical, because you already have an affinity. That's my suggestion. Get more involved in alumni organizations, and to the extent that you have an industry organization that has like a young person's division, or, you know, beginning of your career division, get involved in it. And, you know, don't just sign up for it. Actually get involved. Show up.
Yeah, that's great advice. That's actually a line that I use. You know, Nike has got Just Do It. Mine is Just Show Up. Because it's true, there are ample opportunities, especially in New York City, in this business of sports and media and marketing and sponsorship and things like that. There are so many opportunities to meet would-be connections and colleagues and friends. And for those of us that have been fortunate to be part of it, it's a great thing. It's a great asset, and everybody has a chance to take advantage of it. I've got one more quick one. We've just got a couple minutes left, but I meant to ask you this a little bit earlier, going beyond kind of your professional thoughts. What do you like best about teaching? You've been doing it for like 8 years or so, and which means you've got really good tenure doing it, and I know you do it really well. What do you like about it?
My students. I learn and grow along with them every semester. And every semester has a new constellation of personalities and interests. And the class, every time, really starts to form around the interests, the personalities, the drive, the desire of the students. And I find that as the semester goes on, it has a transformative effect on me. I learn new things, I grow with them, their challenges, their interests. It's really something extraordinary, and it's a gift. And it sounds like a truism or something that is trite, but it is truly a gift for the teacher as well as the student. I get so much energy from my kids.
That's great. I think for those of us, yeah, Joe, I'm sure you can relate to that point, too, and just this idea that, you know, for those of us that are practitioners in the market with our different jobs, but also in the classroom on a week-to-week basis, you kind of have to think of it differently in terms of what you need to deliver, so to speak, And I think that does keep you on your toes, and it does make you stay highly curious and engaged, because you want to, assuming we're all taking it seriously, you want to be on top of everything and really think through what are in many cases really complex issues that, because of the disruption in the business that we've witnessed, are perhaps more complex than ever before. So, Carla, that's all the time we have for the show today. So on behalf of Joe and the rest of the group and our producer, James Appel, thank you so much for sharing some of your thoughts with us about this business. It's been terrific.
Yep,
okay,
thank you, Carla.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. I'm so delighted to have a chance to work with you guys. Thank you.
Yeah, really appreciate it. And for those of you who are interested, there'll be more information about the Legalities in Mixed Martial Arts Symposium, which is going to be on August 15th on the Columbia campus. So check that out, maybe on Google or... Oh, Carla, I'm sorry. One last thing. You gave us a plug for that event. What about you on Twitter? How can people find you?
Just my name, Carla Varialli.
Thanks again, Carla. Really appreciate it. Look forward to seeing you at the symposium.
Okay.
Office.
Thank you.
Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Cusp Show. That's the Columbia University Sports Podcast. I'm Tom Richardson. My co-host is Joe Favorito. And our production assistant this week is Columbia student James Appel. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple's podcast app, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and on other key platforms. You can also see it at blogtalkradio.com/The Cusp Show. And you can get in touch with us on Twitter at CU Sports Biz. That's B-I-Z. Also, you can find out more about our program, the Columbia University Sports Management Program, by going online at sps.columbia.edu/sports-management. Thank you.